The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon. You're beautiful, handsome, you must be very, very smart. I must tell you that I'm delighted and very happy and very pleased to be here. To be here in this great city, in this wonderful state, to be here at this unbelievable historic library. Beautiful, wonderful place. Probably from reading March, book one, you must know that I didn't grow up in a big city like Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or Washington or New York or Boston or Atlanta. I grew up in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a place called Troy. My father was a sharecropper, a tenant farmer. But back in 1944, when I was 4 years old, how many of you remember when you were four? That's very good. What happened to the rest of us? But back in 1944, when I was only 4 years old, my father had saved $300. And with the $300, he bought 110 acres of land. It's a lot of land for $300. We still own this land today. On this farm, we raise a lot of cotton and corn, peanuts, hogs, cows, and chickens. Some of you know something about chicken? Some of you love to eat chicken? But you don't know anything about raising chickens? Well, we'll get there, okay? Because in March, book one, I discuss growing up on this farm, picking cotton, gathering peanuts. I don't eat too many peanuts today because I ate so many peanuts when I was growing up. Don't tell the people in Georgia and in Alabama, where we raise a lot of peanuts, that I don't eat too many of these peanuts. I ate so many peanuts when I was growing up, I just don't want to see no more peanuts. Sometime I get on a flight, flying from Atlanta to Washington, the flight attendant tried to give me some peanuts. I said, no, thank you. I don't care for any peanuts. But also growing up on that farm, we had to work in the field. And from time to time, we would be out there working, picking cotton, gathering peanuts, pulling coins. My mother would say, boy, you're falling behind. And I would say, this is hard work. And she said, boy, hard work never killed anybody. I said, well, it's about to kill me. But growing up there, it was my responsibility to care for the chickens. And I fell in love with raising chickens like no one else could raise chicken. Now, some of you know anything about raising chickens? No. Oh, well, I see a few. Okay, why don't we compare notes here? Well, as a little boy, when it's sitting here and was set, I would have to take the fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under the setting hen, and wait for 3 long weeks for the little chicks to hatch. Some of you may be saying, now, John Lewis, why don't you mark those fresh eggs with a pencil before you place them under the setting hen? Well, from time to time, another hen would get on that same nest, and there would be some more fresh eggs. Had to be able to tell the fresh eggs from the eggs that were already under the setting hen. Do you follow me? Yeah. Oh, you don't follow me. Well, when the little chick would hatch, I would fool these setting hens. I would cheat on these setting hens. I would take these little chicks and put them in a box with a lantern, raise them on their own, get some more fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under their setting hen, encourage the setting hen to stay on their nest for another 3 weeks. I kept on fooling and cheating on these setting hens. And when I look back on it, it was not the right thing to do. It was not the moral thing to do. It was not the most loving thing to do. It was not the most non-violent thing to do. As a little boy, I wanted to be a minister. I wanted to preach the gospel. So from time to time, with the help of my brothers and sisters and cousins, We would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard, like you gather here in this auditorium, and we would have church. The chickens, along with my brothers and sisters and cousins, would make up the audience, the congregation. And I would start speaking or preaching, and when I look back on it, some of these chickens would bow their heads. Some of these chickens would shake their heads. They never quite said amen. But when I really think about it, some of those chickens tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listened to me today in the Congress. And some of those chickens was just a little more productive. At least they produced eggs. Well, that's enough of that story. When we would visit the little town of Troy, visit Montgomery, visit Tuskegee, visit Birmingham, I saw those signs that said white men, colored women, colored waiting. On a Saturday afternoon to go downtown to the theater, all of us little black children had to go upstairs to the balcony. And all of the little white children went downstairs to the first floor. I would come home and ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents why. And they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way, don't get in trouble. But one day in 1955, 15 years old in the 10th grade, I heard about Rosa Parks. I heard the words of Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio. The action of Rosa Parks, the leadership, and the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. inspired me to find a way to get in the way, to get in trouble. In 1956, at the age of 16, in 11th grade, went down to the little town of Troy with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins to the public library, trying to get library cards, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian that the library was for whites only and not for coloreds. I never went back to the Pike County Public Library in the little town of Troy, Alabama, until July 5th, 1998, for a book signing of my book, Walking with the Wind, and hundreds of blacks and white citizens showed up. At the end of the program, they gave me a library card. It says something about the distance we've come and the progress we've made in America. I went off to school in 1957, but before going off to school to Nashville, Tennessee, I applied to attend a little college called Troy State College, now known as Troy University. Submitted my application, my high school transcript, never heard a word from the college. So you know what I did? I wrote a letter to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., told him I needed his help. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote me back, sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket, and invited me to come to Montgomery to meet with him. In the meantime, I've been accepted at a little college in Nashville, Tennessee. An uncle of mine gave me a $100 bill, more money than I ever had, gave me a Foot Locker, one of these big upright trunk. I put everything that I own, my few books, my clothing, in that Foot Locker, everything except those chickens, and took a bus ride to Nashville. And after being in Nashville for a few weeks, one of my teachers informed Dr. King that I was in school in Nashville. Martin Luther King Jr. got back in touch and suggested when I was home for spring break to come and see him. So on a Saturday in March of 1958, by this time I'm 18 years old, I boarded a bus, traveled from Troy to Montgomery. And a young lawyer by the name of Fred Gray, who was the lawyer for Rosa Parks, for Dr. King and the Montgomery movement, and became our lawyer during the Freedom Rides and the march from Selma to Montgomery, met me at the Greyhound bus station and drove me to a church called the First Baptist Church in downtown Montgomery, passed by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, a colleague of Dr. King, and ushered me into the pastor's study to the office of the church. I saw Martin Luther King Jr. and Reverend Ralph Abernathy standing behind a desk. My heart started beating so fast. I was so scared. I didn't know what to say or what to do. And Dr. King said, "Are you the boy from Troy? Are you John Lewis?" And I spoke up and said, "Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis. I gave my whole name. And from that moment on, we became friends. He was my leader, my inspiration. He was my hero, Martin Luther King Jr. As a young person growing up, I didn't like segregation. I didn't like racial discrimination. I wanted to do something about it. So it was in Nashville, Tennessee, a group of students, high school students, college students, came together and we studied the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. We studied passive resistance. We studied thorough and civil disobedience. We studied what Gandhi attempted to accomplish in South Africa, what he accomplished in India. We studied what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was all about in Montgomery. And we started sitting in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion at lunch counters, restaurants. Sitting there in an orderly, peaceful way, no one saying a word, looking straight ahead, someone would come up and spit on us, or put a lighted cigarette out in our hair, or down our backs, pour hot water, hot coffee, hot chocolate on us, beat us, and then we just took it. Because many of us grew to accept the way of peace, the way of love, as a way of life, as a way of living. I got arrested many times during the 60s. Book one, March book one, tell the story of my first arrest. Andrew, who you'll hear from a little later, a few weeks ago discovered a photograph of my first arrest in downtown Nashville. Growing up, my mother and father would say, don't get in trouble. I got in trouble. Good trouble, necessary trouble. But my first arrest, during those days when we were participating in the movement, we wanted to go looking good. We would dress up. I wanted a different suit, a new suit. So you know what I did? I went to a used men's store in downtown Nashville, like being in downtown Philadelphia. And I found a suit. And Andrew discovered this photograph on the front page of the Nashville, Tennessee, in the local newspaper. You know how much I paid for this suit? I paid $5. And I looked good in it. So I wish I still had it. Maybe I could sell it on eBay or something. But I tell you, when I first got arrested, I felt free. I felt liberated. I felt like I crossed over. So during the 60s, I was arrested in jail 40 times. And since being in Congress, another 5 times. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have to speak up and speak out and find a way to get in the way. A way to get in good trouble, necessary trouble. So through the sit-ins, the Freedom Ride, just think, a few short years ago, the same year that President Barack Obama was born, in 1961, black people and white people couldn't be seated together on a bus, leaving Washington, D.C., to travel through Virginia, through North Carolina, through South Carolina, through Georgia, Alabama, through Mississippi. We were on our way to New Orleans. We were arrested, and we were jailed. We were beaten. We were left bloody, but we didn't give up. Just think a few short years ago, next year would be the 50th anniversary, the people in the heart of the Deep South, in Mississippi, in Alabama, parts of Georgia, and other places, could not register to vote simply because of the color of their skin. On one occasion, a man was asked to count the number of bubbles on a bar of soap, to count the number of jelly beans in a jar. How many smart students here can count the number of bubbles in a bar of soap? There were African-American lawyers and doctors and teachers and college professors were told they could not read or write well enough. There were people who were beaten. There were people who were murdered. 3 civil rights workers, Two from the city of New York and one from the state of Mississippi went out on the night of June 21st, 1964, 50 years ago. Stop. Arrested. Taken to jail. Later taken from the jail. Turned over to the Klan, where they were beaten, shot, and killed. These three young men didn't die in Mississippi. Didn't die, rather, in the Middle East. Eastern Europe. Africa, or Central South America, or in Vietnam. They died in the state of Mississippi. They died in the United States of America. So in a few days, as a matter of fact, on the 24th of this month, President Barack Obama going to honor them with others with the Medal of Freedom. So I said to you as young people, as students, you must never ever give up. Never ever give in. Never ever give out. You must keep the faith and keep your eyes on the prize. Now let me say this. As I present a staff person, co-author of this book, March, book one, that would be book two, that would be book three, and that would be book four. This young man was born and reared in Atlanta. He attended some great schools, Trinity University in Connecticut, Georgetown for a graduate degree. And he would tell you that he'd been on my staff for a long time. He's a wonderful writer. He knows all about the new technology, social media. It was Andrew who convinced me that we should do this book, the series. I'm glad that he convinced me that we should do it. So let me present to you Andrew Iden. He's like a friend. He is a friend. He's like a brother.
Thank you, Congressman Lewis. How do I follow that? What do I say? My name is Andrew Iden. I serve as Congressman Lewis's digital director and policy advisor, and I'm the co-author of March. I, like many of you, was a young man who was a bit maladjusted. I was a bit of a comic book nerd. I loved computers. I read. I was raised by a single mother. Right? God bless him. My father left when I was about three, and she did everything she could to raise me. Congressman's been my congressman since I was three. And so to be on his staff and to be able to fulfill my love of comics writing this graphic novel series is one of those things my mother tilts towards the spirit of history. I'm lucky. I made it. There's a lot of hard work in between here and there. Now, some of you might be asking, why did John Lewis write a graphic novel? And it started back on his campaign in 2008. I was serving as his press secretary at the time. And it was coming down to the end of the campaign. And people started talking about what they were going to do afterwards. I'm going to go see my family. I'm going to go to the beach. I said, I'm going to go to a comic book convention. And like you'd expect, everybody on the campaign started laughing at me. And from the back of the room, I hear this deep voice. And it says, do not laugh. There was a comic book during the civil rights movement, and it was incredibly influential. It was called Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story. It was used to inspire some of the earliest protests by Jim Lawson, Dr. King, A. Philip Randolph. It was used throughout the South. And you can imagine me having read comics since I was about 9 years old, what that meant to me. that here was this unbelievable struggle for social justice, for equality, and a comic book had helped inspire some of its earliest days. And so I was 24 years old, not much older than you guys, and I started asking. I just didn't know any better. I started asking, why don't you write a comic book? And the congressman said, oh, maybe. Which, as you probably know, when you hear from your parents or your teachers, is a kind way of saying no. But I didn't stop after I asked that first time. As we kept asking, how do you teach the civil rights movement to a new generation? I would say, well, you could write a comic book. How do you inspire young people to get involved again? Well, you could write a comic book. How do we seize on this feeling of hope and change that Barack Obama has created? Remember, it was 2008. Write a comic book. And so finally, after I'd said this about a half dozen times, Congressman said, okay, I'll do it. But only if you write it with me. And that was a moment that changed my life. I went on to do my grad degree, as the congressman mentioned, at Georgetown while I was working on his staff. I did it at night. Put in your 40 hours a week, and then you go to class. And when it came time to write my graduate thesis, I thought, what do I want to know more about? I wanted to know more about Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story. And so I wrote my thesis on that. I started digging through letters. And what do we find out about this comic? Dr. King helped edit it. I don't know about you, but that really changed my perception of Dr. King. That here was a man who, in the face of bombings, at the time of the birth of his first child, he took time out to sit down and look at a comic book script and make his edits. They don't often put comic book editor on his biography. And yet he did. And we found out that A. Philip Randolph helped use the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters to distribute it. That the Fellowship of Reconciliation and using their nonviolence workshops throughout the South gave that to thousands and thousands of students, many of whom went on to lead some of the first sit-ins, including John Lewis in 1959. And you're probably saying, well, hey, that's cool. What does that have to do with me? And I'm here to say that you are free. You are more liberated than I am. You are more liberated than the congressman. You have no mortgage, no kids of your own. You have the world in front of you. But you also have more challenges than you could possibly know right now. This last election, 1 in 10... young voters actually voted. Look up and down your line. That means maybe 2 of you per row would vote per election. What does that mean in real terms to you? How many of you want to go to college? Good. The tough part is that most of you will have to take out student loans. Right? I did. I'm still paying them. I got a bestseller. Don't you think that higher ed should be free? Yes. Your vote can do that. The chairman of the Education Committee in the House took more money from for-profit schools than any other member of Congress because nobody showed up to vote him out. More importantly, when you read March, you see how a generation of young people use nonviolence to dramatize these struggles. You see how they were able to push and pull and make leaders bend to their will. You're 16, you're 17, you're 18. Not yet, you're getting there. All right. My point is, you're going to be there soon. You're going to be able to vote. You're going to want to go to college. You're going to go out into the world and you're going to see that there are so many things stacked against you that are real challenges Things stacked against me. And you're the only ones who can fix it. We wrote March because we wanted to put something together that would show the principles of nonviolence. Something that would make it plain how you actually start a movement. Make it plain how you challenge your teachers, how you challenge civic leaders, how you challenge the status quo in your community. And this is just book one. We're going to have book two. Actually, we finished editing it last night. It's coming out in January. This book's going to talk about the Freedom Rides. It's going to talk about the Coca-Cola crate that was smashed over John Lewis's head when he stepped off a Greyhound bus. It's going to talk about the lead pipe that hit John Siegenthaler upside his head when he tried to save a mixed group of freedom riders who dared to ride in the same taxi cab. It's going to talk about Dr. King when he went to jail in Birmingham. It's going to talk about Al Hibbler, the blind jazz musician, whose cane and lead was taken away from him by Bull Connor in an act of spite when he simply tried to integrate a Loveman's, which was sort of like a Woolworth's. And more importantly, we're going to talk about the principles that helped force the integration of the buses and public transportation system here in America. I know you think that this future is... But you can't lose hope. And frankly, you are my greatest hope. Because you have the power to change this. And if you read into March, if you take those lessons, if you actually confront your civic leaders, if you confront the politicians and the organized interest groups, the PACs, who put money in front of people, you have the power to fight that through your vote and your ability to protest. Don't let me down. All right? We'll take some questions. Congressman's going to come up and we can... You're going to have a line?
Do you think you could have got secured black people's rights without nonviolence?
You want to fight?
The way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence was the best way. In America, we wanted to create what Dr. King called the beloved community, where we can lay down the way of violence, the way of hate, and create a community at peace with itself. We were struggling against a system, against customs, traditions, and bad laws. We wanted to change. Let me give you one example of what I'm talking about. On the Freedom Ride in May of 1961, I was 21 years old, had all of my hair and a few pounds lighter. My seatmate was a young white gentleman. It was part of the Freedom Ride. We arrived in this little town called Rock Hill. We got off the bus. We tried to enter a waiting room, say a white waiting. We were beaten and left lying in a pool of blood. Now, this is May 9, 1961. In February 09, one of the guys who had been a member of the Klan came to my office in Washington. He was in his 70s. His son was in his 40s. The father and son came to the office. And the man said, "Mr. Lewis, I'm one of the people that beat you in 1961. I want to apologize. Will you forgive me?" His son had been encouraging his father to seek out the people that he wronged. Started crying. He started crying. They hugged me. I hugged them back, and I started crying. Aww. They called me brother, and I called them brother. We wanted to create a society at peace with itself. We didn't own a police department. We didn't own the military. The way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence was the best way. And it's still the best way.
Good question. Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, earlier you said something about higher education, so y'all gonna fight for that too?
That's what we're trying to do. Like, we actually went out to Facebook and Google and try to stir them up because you're going to need technology to organize, right? And this is something we were talking about earlier. The use of social media, right? You guys are really good at that, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's Vines or tweets or Pinterest, whatever, right? This is a tool for communication that they never had during the civil rights movement. As the congressman says, we didn't have a cell phone. We didn't have a fax machine, right? They used a mimeograph machine to hand out, right? The Roland thing. One of the things, because I tweet for the congressman, I do his social media as part of my job. And one of the questions that constantly occupies my mind is, what would Dr. King have tweeted? What would Gandhi have posted? Right? So when you talk about higher ed reform, we've been on the road, we've been talking about this, the congressman's working on it legislatively, but you may have noticed we lost Congress. And I don't think the Republicans really have that as a high priority right now, forgive the partisan comment. You have to agitate. The young people have to force the issue. They have to put it on the table. When the Freedom Rides took place in 1961, JFK did not want to put civil rights at the forefront of his priorities. But the Freedom Rides made him do that. By the time the voting rights struggle happened by the time it came to a head in 1965, Dr. King had gone to LBJ. And he said, you know, President Johnson, we need a Voting Rights Act. We need protection. And he said, I don't have the votes in Congress. I just passed the Civil Rights Act. If you want it, you have to make me do it. And so they went to Selma. They went to Alabama. And they made him do it. Right? You, as the young people, you have these tools. You have all of these opportunities, but you have to make these elected officials stand up and do something about it, whether it's through organized, disciplined protest or through your vote. You have to show up. Well, we have a generation of armchair activists, right? How many of your friends post something on Facebook that's telling them how unhappy they are about something? But you have to show up. You have to do something about it. You have to organize.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question and a follow-up question.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that black people need more equality, or do you think we have an equal amount as the fellow man?
We all need to continue to work, all of us. African-American, white-American, Latinos, Asian-American, Native-American. A. Philip Randolph, this great leader, who was the chair of the March on Washington, who organized something called the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, representing the men working on the railroad, used to say from time to time, when we were organizing the March on Washington, he would say, maybe our foremothers and our forefathers all came to this great land in different ships, but we all are in the same boat now. We got to look out for each other, care for each other. And as long as one person of one group is not free, none of us are truly free.
My follow-up question was, do you think any group, other group needs equality, as in they don't have as much as somebody else?
All people need to be free, free and liberated. And when you travel around America, like I've traveled, not just around America, but around the world, there's still too many people that have been left out and left behind, that people are suffering because of race, color, class, and we just have to continue to work. We'll get there. We will create the beloved community. We will create an America at peace with itself. We will create what I call a truly multiracial, multicultural, democratic society. It will happen. And the struggle is not a struggle that lasts for a few days, a few weeks, or one school year. It is a struggle of a lifetime, or maybe many lifetimes.
Thank you for your question. Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering, what is our generation, like, what is its struggle, like, our greatest struggle today for us? What do you think?
I don't think we have just one.
How many?
A lot. Right? The reason I focus on student loans is because I see it as the opening of the door, right? Let me put it to you this way. John Lewis was arrested 40 times during the 60s, and he married his wife. He met his wife in 1968. You got married in January of 69?
December 68.
When the LA Times ran their wedding announcement, it said, unemployed political activist John Lewis marries Lillian Miles. When people are ahead of their time, they suffer a consequence. And in order for us to allow this generation to truly extend beyond where we are, to be those people who are ahead of their time, we have to do away with student loans so that they can be free to pursue those goals. Once you get that opened up, then there is a litany of issues that we need to deal with, whether it's the environment, access to information, war. As the congressman says, war is obsolete. And there's any number of ways that this generation can fight those struggles.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
How are you feeling when you are marching down the bridge?
If I understand your question, the march across the bridge was March 7, 1965. Next year, we will celebrate the 50th anniversary of walking across the bridge. We were orderly, peaceful. We got to the top of the bridge. Down below, we saw a sea of blue, Alabama state troopers. We got within hearing distance of the state troopers. A man spoke up and said, I'm Major John Cloud of the Alabama state troopers. This is an unlawful march, will not be allowed to continue. I give you 3 minutes to disperse and return to your homes or to your church. And a young man walking beside me said, Major, give us a moment to kneel and pray. And the major said, troopers, advance. And you saw these men putting on their gas masks. They came toward us, beating us with nightsticks, bull whips, shrimping us with horses, releasing the tear gas. I was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick. My legs went from under me. I thought I saw death. I thought I was going to die. Almost 50 years later, I don't recall how I made it back across that bridge. But I do recall being back at the little church. And I guess some people just took me back. And someone asked me to say something, and I stood up and said, I don't understand it. How President Johnson can send troops to Vietnam and cannot send troops to Selma, Alabama, to protect people who only desire to register to vote. The next thing I knew, I'd been admitted to the Good Samaritan Hospital in Selma, Alabama, where a group of nuns took care of 17 of us. But that next morning, that Monday morning, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came by to visit me in my hospital room and said, John, don't worry, we will make it from Selma to Montgomery. And he made an appeal, and more than 1,000 religious leaders, priests, ministers, rabbis, and nuns came and marched. And finally, about 3 weeks later, we made it all the way. And it was not just 600 or 1,000, but it were almost 35,000 people.
Yes, sir.
After all you've been through in the past, how do you feel now that any race could eat at any restaurant peacefully?
Well, I feel very good about the distance we've come and the progress we've made, but I'm not satisfied.
Why not?
I'm not, because there's still people suffering. There's still people hurting in our society. We need to do something about comprehensive immigration reform. It doesn't make sense in a country such as America to have hundreds and thousands and millions of people, and especially young children, living in fear. We can do something about it. Young people afraid to go to school. That's not right.
Yeah.
That's not fair. That's not just. We got to see that everybody have enough to eat, have housing, get an education, get a job.
That's deep.
There you go.
Thanks.
When you were being beat, like all those times you were being arrested, being beat, like what was in your head going on all that time that kept you going? Like was it maybe like Martin Luther King or like what exactly might have kept you going?
What was going through my head during those days and what is going through my head even today, we're going to have a victory. And it won't be a victory for one group, but a victory for all of us. Because I believe if we can get it right here in America, if we can do what is right here in our own country, here in America, maybe it can serve as a model for the rest of the world.
Yes. Hello. Oh, sorry. Hello, Congressman Lewis. Just wanted to say I'm an instructor in case you were wondering why this old person was up. I'm not a student, but it sounds like you're speaking a lot about how the movement, how it's important that youth are involved. You were a young person. The movement was very youth-led movement. And at one point in your book, you talked about how you felt betrayed when some of the older members of your movement, you know, sort of wanted you to accept the partial integration of the department stores. And I guess where I'm trying to get to is there's a youth movement going on in Ferguson, in Missouri, and there are several, the reports I hear that several of the youth are feeling that a nonviolent movement is arcane, is antiquated. It's not appropriate. It's old-fashioned. And I guess I want to hear from you what you think in terms of that. I mean, if, you know, we want to allow youth to protest, we want them to engage in an authentic way. How do we reconcile that?
Well, I truly believe that if you're going to really be consistent, you have to accept the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence as a way of life, as a way of living. It's like saying, today I'm going to be peaceful, and tomorrow I'm going to give up the way of peace. It becomes like a faucet. You can turn it on and turn it off. The way of nonviolence is one of those immutable principles that you cannot give up on. You have to be consistent and persistent. If you want to cure the beloved community, if that's the end, if that is the goal, then the means, the methods, the way must be one of love and one of peace. You cannot say, I'm going to love Sue today, and then I'm going to hate Mary tomorrow. I'm going to love Joe today, and I'm going to hate Andrew tomorrow. The way of love is a better way. Just be consistent. And never, ever give up on anybody.
Thank you.
While telling like your story now, like, do you feel some of the same emotions as you like did in the past? And like, if so, like, which ones?
When you tell the stories today, do you feel the same?
Oh, you know, sometimes I go into a museum. We have this new center in Atlanta, Center for Civil and Human Rights, and I see some of the scenes. Some of the black and white photographs. There's a movie that Oprah is working on right now that's going to be out December 25th called Selma. Oprah and Brad Pitt are working on it. And it's tell the story, and there's someone playing me in the movie. I saw just a little piece of it the other day, and I cried. I literally shed some tears because I saw so many of the people that I knew, that I worked with. And I go back to Mississippi and go to the site where the three civil rights workers were murdered, or go to Memphis where Dr. King was assassinated, or where Medgar Evers, who was murdered in Mississippi in June of 1963. Yes, you have emotions, and you feel it. These are people that you struggled with. These are the people that you were beaten with. These are the people that you almost died with. They became like my family, my brothers and my sisters. And it didn't matter whether they were black or white, or Asian American, or Latino, or Native American. They were part of the family of the movement.
Yes, ma'am.
How did your family feel about you being a part of the civil rights movement?
How does your family feel?
Open. My mother heard that I was involved in the movement, that I got arrested and going to jail. I didn't tell them that I was studying the way of nonviolence, the way of peace, but they read about it, and they saw pictures of me on television. My mother wrote me a letter and said, boy, you went to school to get an education. Why are you involved in that mess? And so I wrote her a letter back and told her I was acting, calling to the dictates of my conscience. This was the right thing to do. And later when we got the Voting Rights Act passed and she was able to register to vote, she became a crusader for everybody getting registered to vote.
Thank you.
And became very supportive.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
If you knew Dr. King was going to get shot, what would your last words be to him?
Well, one thing I regret, you heard me so much earlier. I first met Dr. King when I was 18 years old. Meeting him and following him changed my life. I wouldn't be the person that I am today. He was my hero. He was my friend. Almost like a big brother. I regret more than anything else that the time that I spent with him, whether it was marching from Selma to Montgomery, marching on Washington, or being involved in a protest in Atlanta, Mississippi, or some other part of Alabama, that I didn't ask him more questions and learn more from him. He was a man of faith, and he believed, he loved America. He loved people, and especially young people. He was so moved and so pleased that when people started sitting in, young people, the students, and when people went on the Freedom Ride, when you talk about Birmingham or think about what happened in Birmingham, it was a children's crusade. The children led the way. There were elementary school students, middle school, high school, college students. I don't know what I would have said. I thought he would be around much longer. You know, he was young. He was only 39 years old. He was very young when he was assassinated. He had a great sense of humor. He would laugh and talk and... The last day in Memphis, he was playing around with a group of his staff people. They had a pillow fight. Like I know some of you as students and young people. He was young and the youth and just trying to have some fun.
Thank you. Yes,
Hi.
Ma'am.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, my question is, what could we do to encourage other youth to use love instead of violence?
Well, I think you should read Marge, book one, and then when book two come out, read it. And in book one, it's the do's and don'ts of the sit-in movement. Like, you know, sympathy. I know as young people and students today, because you're so smart and so much sophisticated than we were, we said it was simple things like sit up straight, don't talk back, don't laugh out. But today, we don't know how to say, excuse me, I'm sorry, pardon me. Just be kind to everybody. Dr. King used to say, I shouldn't say this here, but he used to say, love everybody. He said, just love the hell out of it, everybody. Just love everybody. Why should we become bitter and hostile? The way of love is a better way. So encourage people. And you can do it not by just words, but sometimes the way we look at someone or the way we speak to someone could be very violent. So mannerism should be one of peace, one of love, one of kindness. He would say, hate is too heavy a burden to bear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I was just trying to ask you, what were your thoughts about the Black Panthers, and did you think they accomplished something by using the way of violence?
Well, I would say this. I met some members of the Panther. There was a lot of rhetoric. There were people, the first time I left the rural South and traveled to New York, I saw people chanting this and chanting that, what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. You get out of jail in Atlanta. I was in jail like Christmas in 1964 or 63 and had to go to New York for a speaking engagement. And I went to a scenario and everybody was chanting what they were going to do. The people in the South were there on the front line. They were doing it. They weren't talking about it. People, we didn't have any guns. And we didn't have a police department. We didn't have the military. So the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence was a better way. We changed things by not firing a shot, not by beating anyone. Yes, I was beaten, left bloody, and unconscious during the Freedom Rides, during the march from Selma to Montgomery, but we won. We won. Those signs that said white waiting, colored men, white women, colored women, those signs are gone, and they will not return. The only place you're going to see those signs today would be in a museum, in a book, on a video. And you can sit any place, you can vote, and you can. There's someone that told me in 1965 when I was being beaten and left bloody on that bridge, fighting for the right to vote, that one day I would live to see a man of color as president of the United States. I probably would have said, you crazy, you out of your mind.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Oh, hey. This is for Mr. Lewis. I just want to tell you that I admire everything about you. And my question is, can I have a hug?
Yeah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. So I guess I want to say how incredibly grateful and humbled I am to have this experience. I was actually moved to tears while I was standing in the back, especially at the beginning. And so if you would just be so kind as to show your gratitude for our guests today.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.